Okay, so today my goal is to explain how one should probably think of the Sanger-Yazaskal conjecture as a limiting statement as you approach a large complex structure limit point. So to explain what this is, I should first introduce the notion of Gromov-Hausdorff convergence. So this is a notion of distance between compact metric spaces. Well, Gromov-Hausdorff distance, well, how should I say it? It's a metric on the set of metric spaces, compact metric spaces. So definition, it's like X with a distance, a metric, and Y, dy, two compact metric spaces, then we say that the Gromov-Hausdorff distance between these two metric spaces is less than or equal to epsilon if there exist maps f from x to y and g from y to x, which approximately, the idea is that they should approximately preserve distances. And I'll make that precise in a second, but let me just say these maps don't need to be continuous, they're just maps. So the condition is that F and G should be sort of approximately isometries. So the X distance between two points in X minus the Y distance between their images in Y should always be less than or equal to epsilon. That's for all points X and Y in X, so say it's close to being an isometry. And also, G should be close to be an inverse of F. So in other words, the x distance between x and g of f of x should be less than or equal to epsilon for all x and x. And then one should have symmetric statements about the space Y. So the distance, the y distance between two points x and y minus the x distance between g of x and g of y should be less than or equal to epsilon, and the y distance between x and f of g of x, I don't need absolute value there, is less than or equal to epsilon. Okay, so this is just saying that we have these two maps which are sort of approximately inverse to each other and approximately isometries. Okay, so just to give some example, a very simple example, which is basically the only example that we'll really think about, is take a two torus, T2, which we'll think of as being R2 modulo the lattice 1 generated by 1, 0, and 0, epsilon. And we'll take this with the Euclidean, the flat Euclidean metric. So this is a thin torus with one of the directions being a diameter circumference epsilon. something like this. So another metric space is simply the circle, which we can think of as sitting inside there. And so this circle, we have a map F from S1 to the T2, just the inclusion. And we also have a map G from T2 to S1, which is just the projection of the short direction onto the circle. And then it's easy to see that these two maps don't change any distances by more than epsilon. So the S1 is within distance epsilon of T2. So the Gromov-Hausdorff distance between T2 and S1 is less than equal to epsilon. So two metric spaces that are close together could still be very different objects. This shows that the dimensions could be different. You could even just have a finite number of points. If you have a finite number of points in here, such that every point is within distance of epsilon of one of those finite number of points, that finite number of points is a metric space, which is close to this whole thing. So it's a very flexible concept. Okay, so in particular, as epsilon goes to zero, we can actually say that the sequence of metric spaces of metric space structures on T2 is converging to S1. And that fits very much with one's intuitive pictures. As this torus gets smaller and smaller, you can really think of it as approaching a circle. Okay, so there's a basic result. I think it's due to Gromov, which says that the space of Riemannian manifolds of dimension n and Ricci curvature bounded below by some fixed number and the diameter bounded above. Oh, I actually forgot to say this definition is for compact metric spaces. I don't think I put the word compact in there. The reason why we want to bound the diameter from above is that we don't want, for example, the torus getting long and longer. We'll run into some troubles. There are ways of fixing it, but for this purpose, we'll bound the diameter. Now, this space of Riemannian manifolds is pre-compact. In the Gromov-Hausdorff topology. So what that means is that any sequence of such manifolds has a subsequence converges to something, not necessarily a smooth manifold, though. Pre-compact. Yeah, sorry, I keep on forgetting to include the condition. So a good example, again, is the sequence of tori, where the Ricci curvature is always zero, so and the diameter is always bounded, so it converges to something. In this case, it converges to a circle of lower dimension. But something much worse could happen. It converges to something with singularities. All sorts of dreadful things that we don't really know how to control can happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's the space of metric spaces, of compact metric spaces with this metric on it.
Is the subset of finite sets dense?
Yeah. Yeah, because if you take any what you call an epsilon net, so that's a set of points, finite set of points, which is every point is within distance epsilon, will give you.
So this is not very hard here.
Well, it makes use of that fact, but I mean, there's some genuine differential geometry going in here and estimates of sort of counting balls and getting estimates for numbers of balls. I don't remember the exact proof, but. Okay, so as soon as one sees this sort of theorem, one wonders, well, what happens in some standard cases where we sort of have, say, Ricci flat metrics on Clausius? How do these behave? So then the natural question is the following. Let's let x to delta, my delta now is going to be a, I'll say, a disk. Be a degenerating family of Calabi-Yau n-folds. So in other words, x0, the fiber over the origin, will be singular. And let's assume that we are in the case of something resembling a large complex structure limit, i.e. maximally unipotent monodromy. In other words, you have a monodromy operator. If you go pass on a loop around the origin here and follow what happens in cohomology, you have a monodromy operator T. And being maximally unipotent means that T minus I to the n is not equal to 0, but it is unipotent. So T minus I to the n plus 1 is equal to 0. It's a general result of Hodge theory that if it's unipotent, then this will always hold. So maximally unipotent means it's the worst it can be. What was the dimension of the Clausius? Generic, well, it's sort of the worst possible degeneration. So least generic, perhaps, is there. So, I mean, a typical example that everyone knows is such as the degeneration of a quintic to a union of five hyperplanes. That's a maximally unipotent degeneration. Okay, so suppose we're in this situation. Let's fix a possible, well, monodromy invariant, if necessary. Kähler class omega, so we get a Kähler class, fixed Kähler class, which we can think of as being on it, living on each fiber, and then by Yau's theorem, there exists a Ricci flat metric with that Kähler class on each fiber, and so let's let T sub I and delta be a sequence converging to zero. Well, it's 1101. Subtract the identity, it's no problem. Square is 0. No. There are several examples that don't, such as rigid Clausius.
Others?
What?
Others?
Non-Euclidean?
Oh, I don't know any examples offhand, but I'm sure I could think of some bit of that. I mean, there, you know, ones with small numbers of parameters that. Yeah, I think there are some of these Borchow-Voisin threefolds, this K3 cross-elliptic curve modulo in evolution. If the K3 doesn't have a large complex structure limit, the Grabiat doesn't either. And there are some examples. Okay, so and now let's consider the sequence, say, XTI with the metric epsilon IGI, where GI has is a Ricci flat metric with Kähler class omega. And epsilon I is a scaling factor, which is just chosen to make sure that the diameter of this thing stays bounded, say it's constant, for example. That's right. Yeah, so I'll go through this example on the elliptic curve in a second, where we'll see how the scaling should work. So X diameter should be held constant. Okay, so here's precisely the case where we can apply this theorem, and so there exists a limit. And so the natural question is, what is that limit? And why is the reason why that's an interesting question is it will tell us what happens to Ricci flat metrics as we approach maximally unipotent points. And that's important because that's what we need to understand to prove SYZ. We need to understand the behavior of the metric near these points because that's where we expect special Lagrangian vibrations to live, near these large complex structure limit points. So let me do just the example with the elliptic curve. So the standard family of elliptic curves degenerating to node has periods 1 and 1 over 2 pi I log z, where z is the coordinate on delta. Okay, that's where we see the monodromy matrix 1, 1, 0, 1. From the logarithm there. And we can, for example, follow taking specific values of z, we can take a look at some specific elliptic curves, say with periods 1 and I times alpha, where alpha goes to infinity. Okay, now we have various choices for the metric, and what scale we choose for the metric gives different answers for the limit. If we just take the Euclidean metric on this rectangle, of course we identify alpha's sides. If we just take the standard Euclidean metric, then what's happening is this rectangle is getting longer and longer, and we converge to an infinite cylinder. But then, you have to be a bit careful about defining Gromov-Hausdorff convergence because the infinite cylinder isn't compact. So this, as alpha goes to infinity, it converges to R cross S1. Now, you might rescale the metric so that, say, the volume of this thing stays constant.
no risk gain at all.
That's right. Yeah.
So down.
Yeah, I'm about to do the fixed volume area, I guess, would be more appropriate here. So if we rescale, then we need to take periods. You can just keep the metric fixed, but change the periods. And so, for example, 1 over square root of alpha I square root of alpha, we just divide through by square root of alpha. This has constant area as alpha goes to infinity. And this converges to the real line R as alpha goes to infinity. And finally, we can rescale so that the diameter stays more or less constant. Well, maybe not quite constant, but at least bounded, we can take period I and 1 over alpha. And now we get the picture that we had in my initial example. This converges then to a circle. So, I mean, normally it's natural to keep the volume constant, because, of course, the volume just depends on the Kähler class. So if you hadn't done any rescaling up here, if you had taken the epsilon i's to be 1, you would have been keeping the volume constant, and then you would be in this situation. So you would get diameter going out to infinity. So you need to rescale to keep the diameter bounded, and then you'll get something compact. Yeah, in the theorem that I stated, it's pre-compact in the space of compact metric spaces, so you will get a compact limit.
Can it cover beyond the non-equivalent of a compact metric?
Yeah, I mean there are different. There can be, and then the limit will be something different. But let me state the conjecture now to sort of make it clear what's going on. So this is due to myself and Wilson, and independently due to Savich, Sobelman, and Todorov. What is the limit? XTI epsilon IGI converges to an n-dimensional manifold B and there's a dense subset B0 contained in B with B minus B0 being Hausdorff codimension 2. B0 is, yeah, open. Why not? Such that the metric, so remember this is a limit is a metric space, but the metric space structure on B0 is induced by Riemannian metric on B0. Okay, so I mean, the reason for this conjecture should be rather obvious. If there is a special Lagrangian vibration near the large complex structure limit, well, as you approach the large complex structure limit with the suitable normalizations, the volume of the special Lagrangian fibers should be going to zero. I mean, that's generally true that the fibers are the invariant cycle, and the periods over the invariant cycle are going to zero, and that's the volume. So you expect to see this collapsing where various n-dimensional fibers are collapsing down, and the limit should actually be the base of the vibration. B0 will be an open, well, look, let me throw in the word open. There's a dense open subset. Yeah, so B is, maybe it's a manifold. I mean, you know, this is a conjecture, you can write what you want, but maybe B has some singularities away from B0, I don't know, but. So it's the maximal unipotent monodromy that I think is an important feature here. Yeah. I mean, you can have a more subtle definition that it's a maximal depth inside the compactification of the moduli space. That Dave Morrison wrote down a very general Hodge theoretic definition. I think that one just needs this maximal unipotent condition, that's all. Yeah, now of course you want to really have it being a graph or something like that. I mean, let's start with this. Let's just think about dimension, codimension too. Right, I mean, Hauster. I mean, this is a measure theoretic concept, so don't worry about it. It's hard to define dimension when you have very funky sets. Okay, so the idea is that this B should be the base of the vibration. So the other part of the conjecture should be that this B has something to do with special Lagrangian submanifolds. So let me state now another conjecture. Which is really what I think of as being the limiting form of SYZ. So for the first part of this conjecture is a statement, is a true statement rather than a conjecture. Well, let's be a bit less sloppy. Let's call this a remark. Since we're assuming this is maximally unipotent, there's actually a simple geometric characterization of maximally unipotent. You can always find a nice simple normal crossings model. So you can do a semi-stable reduction and make sure that the central fiber is simple normal crossings. And saying that's maximally unipotent is just saying that you have a point on that central fiber where you have as many divisors intersecting as possible, as many components of the singular fiber intersecting as possible. So there exists a point in x0 where x0 locally looks like the product of n plus 1 variables is equal to 0. N being the dimension of the fiber. And that means that in a neighborhood of this point inside X, the map X to delta is given by, say, the coordinate on the base, Z, is equal to the product of the variables xi. So saying that it's maximally unipotent is saying there's a W0, and W0 is Hn of the dual intersection complex. And that means you need to have an n simplex in the dual intersection complex. Okay, so the point is that this local description, you see a torus very naturally. This has a natural Tn action. So just x0 through xn gets mapped to e to the I theta 0, x0 through e to the I theta n, xn, subject to the constraint that the sum of the theta i's is 0. So that gives you Tn with the Tn plus 1 action, because that acts, keeps this monomial invariant. So you have a Tn action here, and any one of those orbits gives you of that Tn action gives you a torus inside the Calabi-Yau fiber. So this gives a Tn inside X, Z, for Z not equal to 0, for Z close to 0. That's right, yeah, this is the local description. It's you're not going to have it globally on the Calabi-Yau. So, I mean, this, yeah, the point is, right, we have some neighborhood that looks like this. This neighborhood contains a Tn, so the Calabi-Yau contains a Tn, but without the Calabi-Yau actually globally having a Tn action. So the point is that this Tn is should be our special Lagrangian Tn, except it's not necessarily a special Lagrangian. We have to try to minimize the volume and find something homotopic to it. So now, so all this is true. Now let's say conjecture. This Tn can be deformed to a special Lagrangian Tn. For on, say, xti, for ti close to 0. And now let's let b0, i be the moduli space of these deformations of these special Lagrangian tori. Okay, so that's exactly the sort of moduli space we studied last time. Once we have one Tn, we have a moduli space which is n-dimensional. But we don't know how far these Tn's can be pushed. Will they fill up the entire manifold? Will they foliate the manifold, give you a fibration? We don't know. Okay, now let's take the code. We want to compactify this moduli space somehow. And there's sort of an easy way to do it, which is rather technical, but let's compactify V0i to a metric space Bi. Technically, we can do this by taking the closure of this space and the space of rectifiable currents, but just suffice it to say, there's a way of turning this into compactifying it and still having a metric space. You're essentially just adding in the singular limits of such tori. Then, if the metric on BI is scaled to keep the diameter constant, that's a genuine model in analytic coordinates. Well, it's not even necessarily Lagrangian, because we don't know what the symplectic or holomorphic forms are in those coordinates. Yeah, but doesn't necessarily mean it's. Yeah, maybe it's Rodman. Well, if the Ricci flat metric has a real, it should be very close. The closer we are to the large complex structure limit, the closer this should be to special Lagrangian torus. Okay, where was I? Then if the metric on BI is scaled to keep diameter of BI constant, then BI converges to B, where B is the same B we had in the previous conjecture. Well, Gorham Hausdorff convergence is always about. The real question is this: do you get the same limit for every sequence? That's really the heart of your question, and I hope so. But at the moment, I've just proved. These conjectures are proved for K3 surfaces, and for that, you take. I'm using a very special family, so it should be. Hopefully unique. That's right. That's right. But we should really, all of mirror symmetry should be about these limits, these degenerations.
But you were saying that in particular, the limit is independent of this choice.
Oh, no. You'll get different limits with different choices of large complex structure limit point.
No, I mean something different. Given the situation, in the central fire, you may have several of these points.
Those points, the n-fold points. Now all those tori will be homologous. Yeah, because they generate the W0, they generate W0, but W0 is one dimensional. Yeah, sorry, I misunderstood the question. I thought you were talking about different large complex structure limit points and moduli. Okay, so in particular, B0 contained in B will be the limit of these B0i, and so we'll have two affine structures. As well as a metric. Okay, so what are the advantages to thinking about it like this? So certainly if the strong SYZ conjecture is true, the one I wrote down last time, then one should expect the statement to be true in a fairly strong way. But here I'm not saying anything about vibrations. And by not saying anything about vibrations, I'm sort of avoiding lots of the technical difficulties in proving this strong SYZ conjecture. So, I mean, one of the advantages is in the limit. We expect, so we have these delta i's, which are the bi minus b0i. If there are special Lagrangian vibrations, then these delta i's will be codimension 1 rather than codimension 2, if Dominic Joyce is correct. But we expect the area of these things to go to 0. And hence should converge to something codimension 2. So that's the sense which, in the limit, we still get a codimension 2 discriminant locus. So that's the first advantage. Second advantage is that since we're only talking about moduli spaces, yeah, so the, so we had this sort of amoeba-like thing, the area. And if it's the area is going to 0, then that means it's getting thinner and thinner. And it's staying bounded. It's not sort of stretching out, too, because the diameter of this thing is bounded. I mean, this is very loose. It's not a proof or anything, but we expect it should go to 0. It should go to a graph. So since we're only talking about moduli spaces rather than vibrations, we don't really need to worry about singular fibers. Or fibers intersect, or special Lagrangian deformations intersecting each other. Or the TNs not filling out a dense subset. So, I mean, let me just talk about this a little bit. The problem in trying to prove the SYZ conjecture was always, I mean, you always run into these sorts of problems. If you have one TN, one special Lagrangian TN you've somehow managed to find, say by deforming this specific TN to a special Lagrangian one, you then still have to try to move it into a fibration. So McLane tells you you can deform it in an n-dimensional family, but a number of things go wrong. You don't know whether it fills out the entire manifold. You don't know how they degenerate. It could be that you sort of have some manifold with boundary as the moduli space, and then you just can't move them anymore because everything's degenerated, all the tori have degenerated. Even worse, the tori could start to intersect each other. So, I mean, all of these problems are, I think, immensely technically difficult problems, which I suspect no one's ever going to solve. So by thinking of it this way, we actually avoid those technical problems. The point is that the base sort of exists in the limit. And it could be that, for example, that for any non-zero value of Ti, these Tn's don't fill out everything. But as you get closer and closer to the limit, you get more and more of the Calabi-Yau filled out. So in the limit, you do get something that makes sense. So what's the problem with this? The problem is, well, actually, let me state the third advantage. I believe that these conjectures are provable. Well, I shouldn't imply I know how to prove them, but I believe they're accessible. That using current techniques, in a few years, one might be able to prove this. So there's a concrete plan of attack. Now, the problem is it's less clear now how we actually construct the mirror. Because now I'm no longer talking about dualizing vibrations because I don't even have a vibration. So how do we... So now the key question becomes, how do we reconstruct a Clausius from B? Yeah. Right. Right.
There is nothing that relates this semi-flat metric to a limit of the
equivalent. Ah, well, you will want to prove that that is close to, so for small values of z, very close to the origin, that that.
The space are completely related because when you take the wrong part of the limit of the Clausius, all the fibers will actually collapse.
Right, but for small, close by. So, you, but the if you take the these torus bundles, then close by. So you take the torus bundles with the fibers having very small volume, and that will resemble the nearby non-singular Clausius. It will hopefully become clear in the K3 case. We'll do precisely that, and it will become clear.
Before you go to constructing the Clausius, how much of this is of what you've said so far is specific to Clausius, as opposed to just max leveling and poor degeneration of anything?
Let's see. I think the behavior. So, I mean, you sort of have C1 less than zero, C1 equals zero, C1 greater than zero. For C1 less than zero, the story is very different. Well, W0 is bigger than 1. But, for example, one can show that there's results of, I think first Tian and then fancy results by Kunlun Lung and Peng Lu, show that if you have a degeneration, say, to something simple normal crossings of varieties with C1 greater than 0, sorry, less than 0, general type, then the Ricci flat metric sort of converges to a natural Ricci flat metric on the non-singular part of the central fiber. So the picture is very different. What we'll see later, actually, well, I might show on Thursday that in this Ricci flat, in the C10, the central divisors sort of shrink down, correspond to points on B. Whereas in the C1 less than zero, the central divisors are really whole components of the limit. The behavior is extremely different. And for C1 greater than zero, I never actually thought about it, but I'm not sure if there's... Yeah, okay, that's why I've never thought about it. So. Okay, so the basic problem with this approach is that we seem to have lost sight of the dualizing. But what we have is, well, we have this base B with the structures, the two affine structures and the metric. And we will need some way to reconstruct a Clausius or a family of Clausius from that data. If we have that, then we can do mirror symmetry, because you start with the maximum unipotent degeneration. You take the limit, you get this B, and then you interchange the role of the two affine structures and somehow construct the family of Clausius, and that gives you the mirror.
show that you can reconstruct what we have in the space, and that's fine, what you're doing yesterday. You don't avoid the problems, because unless you can show none of the fibers crossed and the line, you don't know if it's the flaw we have yourself.
That's right. Yeah. So Thursday, I'll give some hint of how to solve this problem. Okay. So for the remainder of today, though, let me explain how this works for K3 surfaces. So a theorem. This is due to myself and Tom Wilson. These conjectures hold. At least in a fairly generic case for K3 surfaces. I'll make clear what generic means shortly. Now, the content here is not about special Lagrangian vibrations, because we know special Lagrangian vibrations exist on K3 surfaces. They're just elliptic vibrations in a different complex structure. So the difficult part here is the first conjecture about the metric, not the second conjecture. Okay, so let me sketch the idea of the proof. And this will get, I think, more at Tony's question about what one expects to do. So the basic thing is we use the hyperkähler rotation trick. So if you haven't seen this before, let me sketch it. So a K3 surface X with a T2 special Lagrangian T2 vibration, the F from X to S2, this will be an elliptic vibration in a different complex structure. So holomorphic. Now, how do you see this? So this X comes along, of course, with a Kähler form and a holomorphic 2 form. And you can get a new K3 surface just by taking a holomorphic 2 form to be an imaginary part of capital omega plus I little omega. So that's a holomorphic 2 form on a different K3 surface. Well, it's the same underlying manifold, but different complex structure. This defines the complex structure. And omega k is equal to the real part of omega. So the point was that being a special Lagrangian meant that this and this restricted to zero on the fibers, and thus in xk that means holomorphic, because holomorphic means omega k restricts to zero. Okay, so we have fxk to p1 elliptic. Okay, so then one has to understand in this context what approaching a large complex structure limit means. And essentially what it means is that you keep the complex structure more or less fixed, the xk more or less fixed, and let this be a Ricci flat metric for which the fiber area is going to zero. So approaching a large compact structure limit, essentially means keeping xk fixed. It's not exactly correct, but for purposes of this summary, we'll assume that. And letting omega k, well, the integral of omega k over a fiber, F inverse of B, go to 0. Now, one has to be a bit careful about how one does that. One can't, of course, you could just rescale it and the entire K3 surface collapses to a point. That's not what you want to do. If you're holding this fixed, you always want to keep things normalized so that this squared is equal to this squared. So in other words, the volume should be being kept fixed. But the volume of xk should be fixed. So that places a precise constraint on how omega k is allowed to go to 0. We can't just rescale. So what you expect then is the fibers will be contracting down, but then the K3 will have to get longer and longer, too, to keep the volume fixed. So we will have to rescale the metric to keep the diameter bounded. But that's something we can do later, and we'll work with this scaling for a moment. The hyperkähler rotation is here is this xk. This is the rotated. So I've interchanged the two forms which define the hyperkähler structure. And so this defines a new complex structure, new Kähler form, but the underlying metric is still the same. That's right. Yeah. But I'm choosing a specific one.
Yeah, so where is the degeneration? There's some kind of degeneration taking place.
Yeah, so I haven't described the I mean, if you want to go through the full story, I mean, you need to start with one of these families x down to delta. So you look to see what it means for the periods to be approaching a cusp point in the Bailey-Borel classification. That's right. But what I've done is I've hidden most of the issues already in looking at that picture. So the point is you look at the Hodge-Theoretic interpretation of approaching a cusp point, and you see that what it essentially means is this. Okay, so now we've, hiding all those details, we've reduced the following problem. Fx to P1, a fixed elliptic fibration and what we want to do is describe the behavior of a Ricci flat metric of a sequence of Ricci flat metrics omega epsilon with the integral over a fiber being epsilon, and such that the sequence is, this is going to zero. And with constant volume, so the integral of omega epsilon squared is constant. Okay, so what we'll do, well, this is where I'll put in the generic condition. We'll assume F has 24 I1 fibers. So the I1 fibers are the nodal cubics, or if you want, the two-dimensional picture of the pinch tori. So the way we solve this problem is that we construct a very explicit metric on X with these properties, but which is not quite Ricci flat. So this is actually now a very standard thing going back quite some time. Kobayashi and Torov have looked at this in sort of the orbifold limit. You try to get an approximately Ricci flat metric, and then you show, basically running Yao's proof of the Calabi conjecture, you show that that metric is very close to the actual Ricci flat metric. So you go through the proof of the Calabi conjecture and try to estimate the constants that arise. So we'll write down an approximately Ricci flat metric. So how do we do this? Well, we first, it turns out we have a nice semi-flat Ricci flat metric on the non-singular part. So we have this vibration down to the sphere, and we have these singular fibers, and then we have non-singular fibers. And on the non-singular part, we have an explicit Ricci flat metric. So we have B0 contained in B, and B minus B0 consisting of 24 points. X and F inverse of B0. And we can write down an explicit semi-flat metric, Ricci flat. Explicit Ricci flat, semi-flat metric on F inverse of B0. Well, just to show you it's not very hard, I'll write down the formula, but it's probably hard to absorb the formula. So locally, if U is an open subset contained in B0, remember, this B is a P1, so it's a complex structure. So let's let Y be a holomorphic coordinate. On U, and F inverse of U, then we can identify as U cross C, module of family lattices, parameterized, say, by, or generated, rather, by two functions, tau 1 of y and tau 2 of y. So we have a coordinate y on u and, let's say, coordinate x on c. Okay, then I'll write down this
semi-flat metric with the volume of the fibers being epsilon. It's I over 2, W dx plus B dy, wedge dx plus B dy bar, plus W inverse dy wedge dy bar, where W is epsilon divided by the imaginary part of tau 1 bar tau 2, and B is minus W over epsilon times the imaginary part of tau 2 x bar times the derivative of tau 1 with respect to y plus the imaginary part of tau 1 bar x dy tau 2. So that's the metric. It's very explicit. Probably not very helpful to actually say it written down, but at least that way you can believe that it's not so complicated. It's exactly the metric I described yesterday, given a certain affine structure metric on the base. And that affine structure actually comes from the, you can write down explicitly imaginary part of capital omega and little omega, the two forms in the two-dimensional case. This is unique to the two-dimensional case. And from that, you can get the affine structures in the metric, and then this is what the answer is. Okay, now the basic problem is there's no way to extend this metric to a singular fiber, because in a singular fiber, some S1 has to contract down to a point. And if the metric is flat on the fiber, there's not going to be any contraction like that happening. So we're going to have to do something in the neighborhood of the singular fibers. What's that? That's right, yeah. Which is important because we need to be able to glue these together globally. Okay, so we need some sort of metric that lives in a neighborhood of the singular fibers. And fortunately, there's a very nice metric due to Gouri and Botha. So this is a Ricci flat metric. In a neighborhood of an I1 fiber. So I want to go into this construction in a bit of detail because we'll see similar things like this tomorrow topologically. So let's let delta be again a unit disk. With y being, with a coordinate y, sorry. Homomorphic coordinate y equals y1 plus iy2. And let's let y bar be the three manifold delta cross r module epsilon z. So it's just a circle of circumference epsilon cross the disk delta. And let's let y be obtained from this by removing the origin on the circle. So this will be delta cross r minus epsilon z mod epsilon z. Okay, now let's let x to y
in S1 bundle
with Chern class
one.
So the Chern class living in the cohomology of Y, H2 of Y, which is easily computed to be Z, so being one makes sense. Then there's a picture, so we have this S1 bundle over Y, and adding one point, we get Y bar. And it's possible to compactify X to an X bar sitting over Y bar just by adding one point. This is X union the point. So the fibers of this map are S1s everywhere except over the origin, where we get a point. And X bar is a manifold. That's precisely because the Chern class is one that we're allowed to do that. I just removed, well, I removed one point on the circle. Oh, sorry, I've done this wrong. Minus 0 cross epsilon z mod epsilon z, if that makes sense. So let me try to draw a picture. We have circles fibered over the disk, and I remove one point on the circle over the origin. Yeah, thanks. I definitely wrote that incorrectly. Okay, so the important point, so Y bar you can project down to delta just by the projection. So you have a map from X bar to delta. And this is a topological model for the I1 fiber. Let's take a look at the fiber over the origin. So this fiber of this map is an S1. And the fibers of these maps, this map, is an S1 everywhere except at this one point we removed. So this fiber is, well, what we have is we have a pinch torus mapping down to a circle where you have these circle fibers except a single point over a point there. And then that maps down to the origin. So this is what happens over the origin in here. So you see you have an I1 singular fiber. So we'll see this again tomorrow. We're going to construct a lot more examples of singular fibers this way. Okay, so now all I need to do is write down a metric on X bar. So let's take coordinate U. So this we have coordinates Y1 and Y2 here, and coordinate U here, which will be periodic with period epsilon. Now in general, let's let V, well, let's let theta be a connection one form on the S1 bundle, X to Y. With curvature form alpha, which is d theta. But of course, alpha really lives on Y rather than X. Okay, and suppose that V is a harmonic function on Y, satisfying star dV, Hodge star dV, or if you're a physicist, you'd probably write the curl of V, is equal to alpha over 2 pi r. Well, then if we set, say, real part of omega to be dy1 wedge theta over 2 pi I plus v dy2 wedge du, imaginary part of omega, we're just going to cyclically permute these three coordinates. This is dy2 wedge theta over 2 pi I plus v dy u wedge dy1, and omega is equal to du wedge theta over 2 pi I plus v dy1 wedge dy2. These give a hyperkähler triple on x. These define a hyperkähler structure on x. So this is something known as the Gibbons-Hawking ansatz. It's probably familiar to those of you who are experts in general relativity. Any S1 hyperkähler 4 manifold, S1 invariant hyperkähler 4 manifold, can be written in this way. So the nice thing about it is it involves just finding this function v, which is harmonic, so it's a linear equation. Oh, excuse me? The star, yeah, the star is the flat metric. Yeah. It's not complete, no, because you can run off the dis delta. In fact, there's no way to make the metric I'm going to describe complete. There's no variant which is complete. But that's okay, because we're going to glue it into the semi-flat metric.
So why does V exist? Why is delta alpha
exact? You might have to select the right alpha. Right, so what we'll actually do is we'll start with a V such that star dV represents the curvature, represents C1 of the bundle, and then you can find a theta which gives you the right alpha. Okay, so, well, this is a general construction. I mean, you didn't need to use this particular topology to get this Gibbons-Hawking ansatz. But in our case, we can write down a specific V. And the right V, this is the one that Ogurian-Vossler wrote down, is the following. So in terms of electricity and magnetism, this is like putting a row of point charges in the delta cross R space. And we need to regularize the sum, otherwise it's going to diverge, so we're going to subtract something off. And the correct thing to take is 1 over n epsilon if n is not 0. And this is our own term. It wasn't in Ogurian-Vossler's paper. 2 times minus the Euler constant gamma plus log of 2 epsilon over epsilon. this was really just a constant of integration that Gurianov didn't bother to write down, but it turns out it affects the behavior of this metric in a critical way in the limit. Okay, so this choice of V gives you a metric on X, which in fact extends to X bar. So the alpha, you need to check that star dv represents the first Chern class of the bundle, and then there is more or less a unique alpha which satisfies the, or there's a unique, more or less unique theta, well not quite unique, you can add a closed one form, which gives the right alpha. And the particular form of the singularities in V tell you you can extend it to X bar. Okay, so Gurianov wrote down a very nice expansion of this. So you take the Fourier series of this periodic function in U, and V is minus 1 over 4 pi epsilon log absolute value of y squared plus, now I'll write down the rest of the terms in a minute, but let me just say what this would give you. If you just use this for V, you'd have a lot of trouble when y is 0, of course. You wouldn't have a metric there. But you would just get the semi-flat metric everywhere else. There's no dependence on U, so just flat there. You get in trouble when y, absolute y is bigger than 1, which is why, or greater or equal to 1, which is why I use the unit disk. So you have something either outside of 1 or inside 1, but at absolute value y equals 1, you have trouble. And the non-constant term of the Fourier expansion is following lovely 1 over 2 pi I epsilon e to the 2 pi I mu over epsilon times k0 of 2 pi absolute value of my over epsilon, where this is some appropriate Bessel function. And the important point is that this decays exponentially away from the origin. So this is order e to the minus c over epsilon, because we have the divided by epsilon in there for y away from origin. So what we have is we have the semi-flat metric plus this additional bit, which decays very quickly to the semi-flat metric. But the corrections become huge near the singular fiber, even for small epsilon. Okay, so it's the fact that this decays that allows you to glue this into the semi-flat metric without disrupting life too much. And you get an almost Ricci flat metric. So there will be some, you have this singular point in B, and you will have to do the gluing in some annulus away from the singular point. So you get something that's Ricci flat everywhere except where you're gluing, and when you glue, you have a slightly inaccurate metric. So you get approximate. Ricci flat metric, and then you run through the proof of Yau's theorem, and you find it's within order of e to the minus c over epsilon, same, more or less the same band as that, of the actual. Ricci flat metric. Okay, so once you have such a precise description of the Ricci flat metric, then all these conjectures become easy to prove, and you're done. So let me stop with that. Very little. It will tell us a lot more later on, I believe. I'll try to give some hint again on Thursday. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to say Thursday, because I want to talk about some stuff that's work in progress. But this should actually tell us quite a bit in the end. But right now, it doesn't tell us much. Oh, and Kenji, I think, will say something about what it tells us this afternoon. Did you? That's what you promised?
In the five-dimensional case, you don't get nice answers like even Scott.
That's right.
Which are simple invariant. But is the right question the simple invariant, or do you expect a path or something?
Well, you would expect two sorts of, we'll see tomorrow, so two sorts of singular fibers, one which is circle invariant, one is T2 invariant. So one would think
that. The maximal one.
That's right. Yeah. Now, T2 invariant should be easier, but no one's. Did you try to write down, or Conan? Yeah, I mean, a number of people, I've had a student try to write it down too, and I think Ilya Zarkov's trying to write it down. No one's written down a three-dimensional version. But that is a crucial thing. We will need that to prove the theorem. But, you know, I don't think there's any theoretical reason for not being able to do it. One just has to work hard.
More questions?